RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Chris Landry here for another edition of the Landry Football Podcast for this Tuesday, July 23rd. Folks, football season is fast approaching. We had the silly season with media days last week and the Pac-12 this week. And training camps are starting. So, listen, the football season is virtually here, and it's never gone for us here, as we always like to say. But I think everyone's starting to get a little bit excited. Hey, a lot to get to today. Got a couple of questions. Want to apologize up front. I believe our good friend Kevin sent me a question. For some reason, it went into the stratosphere, and it's been lost forever. So, Kevin, if you're out there and you sent a question on Tuesday, July 23rd, resend that again, will you? And I can get to it perhaps on Thursday. It's lost. Didn't even get to see it. But we've got a couple of other questions that we're going to get to today. And a new member of the family. We're going to talk a little bit about the great folks at Manscaped. So we're really excited about them being on board, and hopefully they'll be a big part of our family during this football season. Guys, you're going to want to hear about this. Some great stuff they've got going on. We're going to get into, again, our X's and O's series. We're going to talk a little bit about kind of the defensive side, but we're going to talk a little bit about the evolution of where things are schematically and some of the offenses, and then we're going to get into some of the defenses. That's the 3-4 versus 4-3 fronts. That's what we're going to get to in the next 2-3 podcasts. So if you've been a part of listening to this series, you've seen how quarterbacks think, how cool running backs think, how wide receivers, tight ends think, how offensive linemen and what their responsibilities are. We're going to take you through every step of it the way. So we're really excited about that. A couple of questions we want to start out with. First of all, something that is related to LandryFootball.com, and reminder that to get detailed information analysis that are even greater in-depth than we have here, we want you to go to LandryFootball.com, take advantage of the Heading Towards the Season special, the scouting season sale that we have, a great opportunity to get involved and get all the breakdowns and get prepared for the football season like you have never seen before. So really excited about that and the great opportunity. So take advantage of it, the pro game, the college game. You're going to love it as you get ready for the season, and then obviously all the way through the season, through next year's draft. So great opportunity to get involved. But Jacob says, and I answered him on this, but I wanted to make it in case it was something that I think is important for everyone to hear, is he says he was looking at the AFC East depth chart in grades. And he says, am I misreading this? Seems like some teams have guys higher on the depth chart than other guys who you have a higher grade on. Yes, that is true, but it's rare, but it does happen. But let me just go back to the grades again and what the grades are. And I updated it so you can go back and look at it. You know what the color grades mean. And the reason why we put the color grades is that the reason why we do it in the NFL is it gives you a color grade that stands out, that gives you an indication of how many blues, how many reds, how many purples, how many oranges, how many greens that you have on your roster. And you know what the blues mean. They're the highest grade. Then the reds, players that win for you. Purples are starting production. Oranges are backup production. And greens are young guys that may be headed towards a blue, red, or purple grade or orange, but at this point they're greens. Here's the thing I've tried to explain in the grades, and I've made a little greater clarification for you because of Jacob's message, and I think it's a good one, and I appreciate this feedback because sometimes it gets lost. I've been doing this for so long that people are kind of new to looking at it, may see it differently. So when I grade players in the blues or the reds, there's a different shade of blue or red. So, for example, dark blue, light blue. I noticed that in some of the colors, some people have a hard time differentiating colors, and I get it. Some of them are confusing. That's why I put it to it with the in the grading scale. So the red, obviously, you know what the red means. But a lighter shaded red, which on this chart is basically a pink color, I consider in terms of the color options that I have, it's just a lighter shade of red. Pink is kind of how I look at it, or how we look at it in the league. But if you look at the lighter shade of red, which is pink, and the lighter shade of purples, and maybe the lighter shade of orange, sometimes people get confused because they maybe look similar. So look closely at it. Sometimes what you're seeing is that are guys that are graded higher than others on the depth chart are really not. You just may be misreading the colors, if you will, which is understandable. So we hope that helps you with a little bit. But, Jacob, there are some scenarios where a guy is graded higher than there is on the depth chart. But understand something. The depth charts are where the teams are putting guys right now. The depth chart doesn't necessarily tell you who the best players are. That's where they are right now. That's where they're anticipating giving the most snaps at this point. And then we'll see how the depth chart, you know, plays out. And it also may be to the fact that a guy may come from another team, was graded higher, but in this stage may not be as high up on the depth chart now. Or in some cases, because they signed him, may be graded higher on the depth chart, but may not be graded as high. And situationally, they may be a really good player in the pass game, but may not be as good in the run game. So there's a lot of factors that can contribute to that. So, yes, there's some cases where a guy is given a backup grade and is ranked a little bit ahead, whereas the guy that is a higher graded guy that's in a backup role. So, yes, and that's important, because what do normally people do is say, well, he's a starter, so he's got to have a starter grade. No, there's some guys that are given a starter grade that may be in a role where they're backups at some spots. And then in other cases, you've got backup caliber players starting. Yeah, here's the other thing. Depth charts how where the teams have them, and the grades are where I have them. So there's a little bit of a difference of opinion there. Doesn't make me right. That's how I see it. So hopefully that kind of clears it up. Jacob also asks a good question about, can you tell when you're scouting players whether there will be injury prone? Is there something in certain styles of player body types that lead to it? Injury prone has a lot to do with injury history and how many injuries they've had, where the injuries have been. I worry, for example, more about guys that have any spinal issues, neck or backs. Those are chronic. Those are always going to be a problem, and they go to the longevity of a player. Now, some people are not as concerned. If they can get one contract out of a player, they're not as concerned about it. But I always look at longevity of a player as a factor, because when you look at it, is ideally, I'd like to draft a guy that I think is going to be a good player, and it's going to be more than a one-contract player. You know, I think that's a big issue and something that I always look at and focus a lot on. So I look at definitely the type of injuries and the recurring part of the injuries. But you have to study a little bit about the injuries in this regard. So, for example, if you've got a chronic injury to one body part, well, is it a chronic injury? Is it a knee or a shoulder or an Achilles or something that is significantly bad? Is it a chronic problem that will always face them? Or is it perhaps a case where a guy just came back from an injury too quick? For example, some people thought Deuce McAllister was injury-prone coming out of Ole Miss. Well, he wasn't injury-prone as much as he came back too early, and so the injuries kept recurring and recurring. So he's injury-prone. Well, yeah, he was injury-prone because the injury didn't heal correctly. You got to study the medical part, and you got to really see the timeline of, okay, here's where the injury took place in college, here's when he came back, and you got to do some medical scouting where you got to get your medical people involved. Hey, did he get enough rehab time here? Maybe there's a little bit of, you know, you don't ever publicly question somebody's medical staff or coaching staff, but sometimes they just came back too quickly. I look at that. I also look at, does the guy have a variety of injuries? You've probably heard me tell the story. I whiffed on Curtis Martin. I had a high grade on Curtis Martin. Loved him. Wanted to draft him. Was going to draft him. I just waited one round too long. Why? Because he had a myriad of injuries at Pitt. It was a problem. And it was in the, he lived in the training room. And it was everything. It wasn't one thing. So I thought, this is going to be a problem, particularly at that position. And it wasn't. Go figure. You know, you look at it, always in the training room, always a problem. You think at the running back position, it's going to be volatile. The guy was as durable as anybody. You also have to look at how a guy is as a worker in the training room. You want to talk about somebody that's a good worker. See how they handle rehab. That's the toughest thing in the world to do, folks. Toughest thing. It is not that difficult to be motivated for practice, to play. It is tough as all get out to get ready coming off of an injury. Why? You're by yourself with a trainer. You're not part of the team. You're not part of the game plan. You're having to get better. That's tough. That's a tough thing. You show me a guy that, because you don't like rehab, it's just what you have to do. Somebody that is diligent with that, that shows up early for treatment, that shows up early for rehab, that works hard and does the extra things. What else can I do, Mr. Trainer, to get a little bit better? Follows directions. You show me somebody that does that, I show you somebody that's going to get better as a football player, assuming he's got the ability to learn, the capacity to learn, because that's the toughest thing. So I study all of that. Yes, there are things you can tell, but then there's some things that you just can't predict. A freak injury takes place, and as your body gets older and matures, it puts stresses on other parts of the body. And there are just some things you can't predict. So hopefully that answers your question there. Got another question that I want to get into or answer. It's about, it's an open-ended question. But what would I do if I was, Chris, make you the czar of football at all levels? What would you change if you had complete control and change everything? What changes would you make? Okay, well, I'll get into that. And let me preface this by saying none of this stuff is ever going to happen because some of it's not even legal in terms of what can you prevent to do. But I'm going to take your question at face value, and I'm going to go through all levels and try to give you some snapshots of what I would do. I can't. It would probably be an eight-hour podcast to go through everything, and I'm not going to subject you to all that. But here's what I would do as a czar of football, changing things the way that I think would be better for everyone involved. All right, the high school level, I would create more opportunities for kids to be able to learn the game, learn tackling. I'm a big believer in the concept that Pete Carroll and Bill Belichick have in tackling, the rugby style tackling, which you can tackle. And I'm going to talk about that here in the ensuing podcast when I get into tackling and defense. The ability to tackle with the shoulders first. You could work that even in charts and without pads. I would teach the fundamentals of football a lot better, and I would allow for more of those opportunities for spring practice to be involved. In concert with doing your schoolwork, I think practicing your trade a little bit more at the high school level is what I would do in general. There are other things that I won't get into, but just in terms of how you teach, and more ways to clinic and help coaches become better coaches at the high school level to prepare them. That's what I would do. But I would let the kids learn more about football, spend more time studying football. With technology, I think you need to do things to prepare kids to play football and understand football. Get them to learn how to take notes. Get them to learn how to study. Get them to learn how to teach one another football. You do that, and now you've taught kids how to do something that's going to help them in school learning math and science and English, because you become a better note taker, you become a better student in learning academically. Here's the other thing I would change overall in recruiting process. I would change the rules. Again, it's not going to happen, but I'm going to do whatever I want to do and make it stick. No kid would be able to be recruited or would be able to commit to a school until after their high school career is over. So, no, we're not recruiting 9th graders, 10th graders, 11th graders. Not doing that in my system. you would play your high school career. The colleges would be able to look at film of you, would be able to go to watch your games, and could do their study of you on you. But you would not have recruiting visits with college coaches until your college career is over. And that is no leaving early. You're going to spend your high school career in high school. There's no, we're going to go and get done early and you're going to enroll in college early. None of that would happen in my way. The college career would be over. Signing day would be moved back. There wouldn't be an early signing day. You would have the evaluation time as of December of the high school career as it's over. The college coaches would have January, February, and March to evaluate players and recruit players. Excuse me, you can evaluate them before, but you can then recruit them for 3 months. And signing day would be the end of March. And you'd figure out where you want to go. You then would sign your scholarship. And then you would not be able to go to spring practice, of course. You're still in high school at that point because you're going to finish until May when your high school is over. But you're going to be able to decide in late March, early April, where you want to go to college. Then you can enroll in college as early as the summer to get started in your college classwork. That's how it would be done. So you wouldn't have the early offers where you have misevaluations of players. You wouldn't have early commitments where kids are deciding where they want to go early because they don't know who's going to offer, who's not going to offer, yada, yada, yada. And then they're going to have all these transfers that lead to the result because schools make mistakes and kids make mistakes and you were doing things too soon and too early. Yeah, that's how I would do it. Now, here's the other thing that would shock you, amaze you, frustrate you. This is what I would do. This is the question I'm answering. You would not be eligible as a freshman in college. That's correct. You'd go to college your first year. You're going to pass 36 hours of credits between the summer and the fall and the spring and in a legitimate degree. And when you complete those hours, you would then be eligible for the start of what is your second year. Everyone would just be ineligible there. You'd still have 4 years on top of that to complete your eligibility if you choose to do so. But you'd be ineligible for your first year. You get involved in academics. You'd learn that. You would be able to practice. You would not play. You're going to have a chance to physically and emotionally develop. And that's how you would handle it in my world. Here's the other thing. You would then have a first year to get your jump start on academics. Then what you would do, be eligible that second year, assuming you're eligible academically. Okay? And you would play at 4 years of eligibility at that point. If you graduate in 3 years in a legitimate degree, you could then go early. If you graduate, I would not have early entry into the NFL in my world. In fact, you would have to have a college degree to enter the NFL. What? Are you insane? Well, yes, I am. Here's what I'm getting at. As a college coach, most of these kids can learn. We don't put enough emphasis on those kids developing their study skills in school and high school, and we don't put enough emphasis in college. I see the 95% rule of these guys are not going to go to the NFL. They need to get a degree. They need to learn how to study. They need to prepare for their life after football. And their life after football is probably after their college career. If they have a great pro career, so be it. Have it with a degree. I'm going to get into that in a second. Got to have a college degree to get in the NFL. It's going to take 4 years. There would be no early entry into the NFL in my world. Oh, but that's illegal, Chris. I know it is. I'm making this like I want to in a perfect Shangri-La, you know, world. It's not going to happen. But I would make it to where a guy would have to get a college degree. He enters the NFL more mature, more educated, the ability to learn in the speed of the pro game. And guess what? He would make less mistakes, stupid mistakes, being more educated. He'd make less mistakes, blowing away his money. He'd prepare for his life after football better. He'd have his degree. Why the hell you want to go back to college when you could spend your time in college? Oh, by the way, here's the other thing I would make mandatory. Once you go to a college, the college is on the hook to pay you if you apply yourself academically. They can pay your four-year degree, and they're going to pay your graduate degree, whether it's a master's, whether it's a doctorate, whether it's on to law school, medical school, dental, whatever. University is going to pay for it. That's where we need the focus on. We need to focus for the 95%, not the 5%. Get those kids to prepare academically. And the ones that are going to go play pro, they're going to be doing something else one day anyway. Why not prepare themselves to take care of their money and prepare themselves for, as Chuck Noll used to say, for your life's work? Because football playing is not a career. It's a job. It's a temporary job. So that's what I would do. So you would not have early entries into the draft. You would play 4 years in college and you develop there. If you got your degree in 3 years, then you can come out early. And if you do that, it's going to make you a better pro player. Then, you know, in the NFL, the way I would do it is I would lessen the free agency and the development. I think that there is a counterproductive way of rewarding those organizations that scout and develop players. So free agency would be limited. Again, can't happen because we've opened that door. But I think that if you sign a player, if you draft a player, sign a player, develop them, you should be able to keep him by making him a standard offer that is the requisite of, if you're going to make him that offer, you're going to have to pay him a certain level that allows you to keep him. But I would restrict free agency, and I think that would improve the development. Now, maybe seemingly un-American, but, you know, this is different. It's a different sport than the regular world, and I think we try to make this too much like the regular world, of which this is a little bit different. So that's are some of the things that I would do to make the sport better in my mind. I would also require, and again, CBA doesn't allow this, allow for more practices in the offseason for players. I would provide more guaranteed money for players that get injured because it's a volatile sport. But in order to get better, in order to prepare your body, to become a better tackler and a better football player, you got to practice more in the offseason. So as the season would get a couple of months off after the end of the season, then you would have what I call gradual mini camps. And so what would happen is you would have a few days of walkthroughs, a few days without pads, and you work your way into pads and you practice. Then you tail off and you give a month off and you come back and do it again. You'd have more of that, more teaching of football. I think putting the money in place to where guys are going to get paid very well, but where there's a little bit more balance in terms of how we pay guys and even all year round, I think is something that we need to do and look at. That's what I would do. Again, none of this is going to happen, but you asked, I've answered it. Hey, want to tell you about good friends at Manscaped as before we get into talking about some more of the X's and O's. Great folks that are coming on board, and we want to tell you about the great work that they do in terms of helping you out and all of your needs in terms of grooming from a manly standpoint. Folks, excited to welcome to the family the fine folks at Manscaped, the number one in below-the-belt grooming. They offer precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. That's exactly right. That's why Manscaped has redesigned their electric trimmer. Their Lawnmower 2.0 has proprietary skin-safe technology, so this trimmer won't nick or snag your family jewels. Manscaping accidents are finally a thing of the past. And don't use the same trimmer on your face as you use on your nether regions. That's just nasty. Manscaped also has the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why not put deodorant on the smelliest part of your body? Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code Landry. That's L-A-N-D-R-Y at manscaped.com. Always use the right tools for the job. Your nether regions will thank you. Again, get 20% off and free shipping with the code Landry, L-A-N-D-R-Y, at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code Landry. Don't forget. As I get back into the X's and O's conversation, I want to get into a couple of things and kind of finish off a little bit of the offensive talk before we get into the defense and some things that have happened in the past that's kind of shaped the flow of offensive football. And you know, if you go back into the 60s when I really started studying the game, most NFL teams ran the ball on first and second down and hoped to get into third and short. And then that third and four range gives you the down and distance that you can run or pass and keep the defense off guard. That's what was the goal at that point. Then what really changed was the AFL. And it's, you know, mad bombing quarterbacks and you're throwing the football all over the place. And a lot of young coaches that had offensive innovative ideas, they couldn't get jobs in the old, you know, NFL and the old way they did it. And so they didn't go by the old rules. They weren't afraid to throw it some more, regardless of the down and distance. So when you have that, what I always explain about football is you have an action and an equal and opposite reaction. And after the merger, the defenses had to find a way to evolve, and then they came up with the ideas for defending first and second down passes. Dick LeBeau, one of the great defensive backs and great defensive coaches, coordinators in the league, saw the future of offensive strategy. And when he became a coach, he created new ways to pressure the quarterback. And we're going to get into the zone blitz a little bit later. Not today, but going forward as we kind of break through the defense. He realized that you had to defend the pass and stop the run all with one call. So he decided to blitz on early downs. And if a team was in an I formation and had a great block and tight end, LeBeau would blitz from the strong side. If a team called a run, it would be right into the blitz. If it went to play action pass, someone would be coming right at the quarterback. Behind the blitz, LeBeau would play bump and run coverage, just like he played as a corner himself under three deep zone. The result, if the blitz didn't get the quarterback, any completion would go for a short gain. You rally to the receiver, and there you go. That's how it began to evolve. Well, then Bill Walsh came in, and then he took those short gains, and he set up the receivers after the catch. And his pivotal innovation was to have his receivers run slant routes against the blitzing defenses. That way, when one of Walsh's receivers caught the ball, he'd be running into the middle of the defense, not out of bounds, and was running against vacated guys in coverage. Jerry Rice had a Hall of Fame career because he ran slant routes for the 49ers. And then they took the other receivers, be it Freddie Solomon first, then John Taylor, and then tight end Brent Jones. They ran shallow crossing routes, one at 5 yards, one at 11, and one from the other side. It didn't matter where the blitz came from. Montana would simply throw the other way and someone would be open. Just numbers. It's a numbers game. Somebody's going to be open. That's a simplified example of how things change in the NFL, but it's a pretty good representation of the chess match that takes place and how defense try to find a way to solve what the offense is doing. Then the offense responds, and it's like a pendulum. There's no question about that. Let's talk about the quarterbacks. Things have changed. You know, what's the difference? Well, you're seeing more mobile quarterbacks, running quarterbacks. However, it's still about being able to make plays from the passing game. We've seen direct snap quarterbacks, and we've seen guys that can run. But if you don't have the threat of passing, then your effectiveness to run as a quarterback doesn't work. That's why the Wildcat didn't last. It was not an offense, but it was a play. And the concept didn't last very long because, quite simply, you had no pass threat. So you didn't worry about the pass. And the way you defended the Wildcat is you blitz the formation. You blitz the mesh point of the handoff. You're not worried about defending the pass because they're not throwing it. So it had to become a situation where, you know, it's not just a run threat quarterback like in college. That's not going to work consistently. So you got to find the read option and the option of being able to throw the football off the run. And so you see some of that. Russell Wilson was very innovative. Seattle was very innovative with them. You could take the read option, and I'm going to tell you how they determined. Russell Wilson didn't run read option in college. Ran a conventional offense. But when Seattle had him, when they were preparing to play against Colin Kaepernick and the Niners, they used Russell Wilson because of his ability as a runner to run some read option against them to prepare. And when he did it so well that they decided, they meaning Pete Carroll, and offense coordinator Darrell Bevell, they figured, you know, this would be some good things to implement into what we do. So they went about implementing some RPOs, and the concept of the read option is pretty straightforward. The quarterback sticks the ball in the belly of the running back and then reads the last defender on the line of scrimmage. If that defender crashes down towards the running back, the quarterback pulls it out and takes off around the edge, now vacated by that defender. If the defender stays square, he's basically identifying himself as a contained player, staying outside to keep the quarterback from escaping. In that case, the quarterback completes the handoff to the back. Unlike the wildcat or the run and shoot before, and I've got a question on the run and shoot that I'll get to in a second, the wildcat and the run and shoot, the read option is sustainable because it's rooted in the old age offensive staple, running the football. It's not about how often you run it. It's really not how effective you run it. It's about the respect that they have to get you for running it. And if they don't think you're going to run it, they can tee off against the pass and your quarterback's going to get killed. The quickest way to slow down a pass rush is to be able to run the football. And a guy like Russell Wilson doesn't flourish in the read option because of the time he keeps the ball and gain 7 yards and get out of bounds untouched, which he does very well. The best quarterback in the league at getting untouched when running the football. He does it because of the threat of the running game to the back, the handoff to the back, gives to the defense. So it's really not, it's a read option, but the offense would really like to run the football and only threaten the quarterback, maybe keeping it. That way the defense has to assign someone to the quarterback, which should create a number of advantage for run blockers. So the goal in the read option is to give the ball to the back 80% of the time. And sometimes, you know, you'll hand off even when the end crashes down, just so the defense doesn't feel it can dictate, you know, what the offense is going to do with the ball. So you want to have that run option, but you're not going to run your quarterback a whole lot. And if your quarterback does run, he has to have the innate ability to get out of bounds or to be able to slide, which no one, again, does it better in football than Russell Wilson of just doing that. And that's just sliding and not getting hit. So the read option contains that option to pass. This is where kind of the RPO element comes in. When you have a quarterback who, like Wilson, can pull the ball down out of the belly of the back and throw on the run, you've created a new dimension, which stresses the defense. And this is what we're seeing a lot in college. And then we're absolutely seeing it in the pro level. So the quarterback's threatening to flank with the run, but he can take 3 steps, then throw the ball to a receiver on the boundary, and the defense can't defend against a quarterback keeper, an inside run, and the rollout passer all at the same time. So that's a step that, for example, like the Wildcat never took. Another factor in, you know, kind of the offense is running out of the shotgun. Now, the read option is really born out of the fact that the quarterbacks can run it out either the shotgun formation being 7 yards behind the center or the pistol, 4 yards. So from the starting point in either formation, the quarterback has an easier post-snap read than the traditional run call with him under center. When he starts a play under center, he takes the snap, turns his back to the defense, and extends the ball to the back without the ability to see what the defense is doing post-snap. The defense could do a bunch of things to change what the quarterback saw pre-snap. In the shotgun or the pistol, the quarterback never has to take his eyes off the defense. He's looking at it the entire time. So it used to be that you always were very concerned about a quarterback that has no experience under center. Now, I still have that because you have to do some things under center, but it's less of a problem than before because the league has adapted to, you know, the amount of snaps under center to the degree of about 75% now are out of shotgun. So it's a shotgun league. There's no question about it. Now, it does affect play action, and so the ability to get under center, short yardage, goal line, play action, you want to have the ability to learn under center, but learning and playing out of the shotgun has never been more important than it is at pro level, and at the college level is definitely done because it favors a lot of making it easier for the quarterback to, it's simplified reads, and they never take the eye off the defense. So, you know, listen, you tried smart coaches try to build offenses with both concepts, and the defenses hate the idea of having to deal with both over the course of the game. You can line up your quarterback under center, triggers the defense to make one call, then shift your quarterback into a shotgun, bringing the read option principle into play, and the defense now has to get out of the initial call and into a new one. So, listen, it just is a constant game of adjustments that we call in strategic football. I do want to answer one question that was asked, is that what killed the run and shoot offense? What caused it to die? And the answer is really simple. And the team that ran it the best was the Houston Oilers with Warren Moon, but they couldn't protect the quarterback, pure and simple. Now, he was able to get the ball out quickly enough, but most offenses tried to run it, their quarterback was killed. So that gimmicky run and shoot died because the quarterback got killed. You didn't have a tight end in the game, so you became soft on the edges, protection, and those edge rushers just teed off on your quarterback. Here's the other thing that people don't understand. When you build a roster around a run and shoot style, and even to the degree of the greatest show on turf with Mike Martz, think about it, no tight ends. Okay, so what you do is you need to carry extra receivers on the rosters. That you cut a tight end or a fullback. Well, then, you know, now the second and third tight ends and the fullback, they're your core special teams guys. Now you've taken some of the best special teams personnel and you eliminate it off your roster. So, you know, you got, you know, 5'9", 170-pound receivers trying to do what fullbacks and tight ends do in special teams, you get killed. That's why those teams were so awful on special teams. You can't stop any return unit doing that. So that's something that is a big picture item that you need to understand. And it's one of the things about the read option and the RPO game is that you still have the element of the tight end. You can still run fullback stuff. Look at a lot of the things. Now, the Saints, for example, they don't run RPOs, but they run a lot of shotgun. They use a fullback. They use tight ends. They go four wide. They do a lot of things, obviously, because the quarterback can handle it. And the play caller as a head coach in Sean Payton is as good as any in football doing it. But they don't diminish their special teams unit by personnel, whereas an offense like the run and shoot that's completely different than what the Saints run, it was dictated by having different personnel, which is going to negatively affect your special team. So, hey, we're running out of time for the day, and I am going to pick up and get into defensively. Going to start talking about the job descriptions of the 3-4 personnel and the 4-3 and start to get into what the units look like, the differences between the two. So we're making our way through the entire playbook, the entire schemes, making you a more educated football fan, get you ready for the football season. You're going to see the game a lot differently this year than you ever have before. So we appreciate you joining us today. We appreciate you joining us on Thursday on another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer Quick Picks on Radio Influence.
This week on Sitting Ringside, we welcome Shannon Moore to the podcast. We're going to go back in time and talk to him about growing up with the Hardy Boys, growing up with Matt and Jeff Hardy and practicing and mimicking what they were doing on trampolines and how that has led to all three of their success. It's a cool story. Also, he talks about getting into WCW, how he was on the to-be-fired list, who saved his career, and what was the gimmick that saved it. Also, his feelings when he went to the WWF after WCW went out of business, being a part of WrestleMania and reuniting with the Hardys, and his reason for his WWF release, the Hulkamania Australian tour, which I heard was one big party, plus going to TNA, teaming up with Jesse Neal and Ink Inc., and life after wrestling, what he's doing now, and his success in the tattoo business. All that and so much more this week on Sitting Ringside. Be sure to download wherever podcasts are available, and don't forget to rate and review.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.